1220 WGN.
Hello, this is Karen Conti. Welcome to the show. We have a great show tonight. We're going to be talking with John Coletti, who's the owner of one of my favorite restaurants in the city, Gibson's. And one of the things that I wanted to say was it's Valentine's Day coming up, one of the biggest dining days in the year. And I just saw a really interesting article. A study was just done that said that people who are single might just be happier, which is not what we've heard all along. We used to hear that it was Noah's Ark, it was two by two, married people are generally happier than people who are single. But this new study says that there are benefits from living alone, like you're more social, you reach out to other friends, and you socialize with people who aren't your family or your spouse, that you have more time for leisure, more time for exercise, more time for hobbies, and you have less debt. Single people have less debt. That's probably because people who are married tend to have children, and children, of course, are a big drain on your income and expenses. It's also true that single people sleep better. Sleeping alone, you get better sleep than if you're sleeping with somebody. And just generally, they say that people who are single have more what they call personal growth, which means they tend to do things outside the marriage, outside the relationship. And as a result, they try new things, take vacations in new places, and that might, in the long run, make people happier. But we don't know. I don't know what's the answer to that question. But in any event, if you don't have a date on Valentine's Day, maybe you're happier in the long run. But if you're going out to dinner, like millions and millions of Americans, I think they're going to spend $8 billion on February 14th with a quarter of Americans eating out. We have with us in the studio talking about the best restaurant in Chicago. It's John Coletti. John, welcome to the show. I'm so happy you're
Thank
here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, as much as I love doing this show, what I'm really looking forward tonight is to turning off the microphone and going over to Gibson's.
God bless you.
Having a glass of wine, having some good seafood, and I'm just looking forward to it, but I'm really happy you're here. So you've been doing this for a long time. You've been doing it since you were born. Your family is a family of restaurateurs. Is that correct?
Yeah. My cousins still have the original restaurant that my parents started in 1946, which is Coletti's on Elston and Central. And I've been at Gibson's now going on 25 years. The restaurant's 29 years old.
You know, Gibson's is the most successful restaurant in the city, and it has been for years. It grosses more than any other restaurant. I think it's $26 million or something like that. And it's number 8 in the nation, if I'm correct about the stat for last year. You know, that's just amazing. And what's amazing, John, is not just that you had one good year. Mm-hmm. You've had a lot of good years. And I guess what I want to know is, all these restaurants popping up, coming and going, and your restaurant maintains. How does that happen?
Well, first of all, it takes a lot of work. And I think it started, the philosophy of our business started with my partners, Steve Lombardo and Hugo Rowley, when the restaurant opened in 1989. And it was had to do with a lot of work, but it also had to do with caring for the customer and being true to the customer. A lot of restaurateurs, I think, in our world are there for the cash register. Our company philosophy was to give great service, great food, have them come back many, many times. The service philosophy is a big, big thing for us.
What is good service to you? I mean, obviously, we all know when you've got an inattentive waiter or somebody who is maybe too attentive. But what are the elements of a good waitstaff?
Fast, efficient service with a smile is one thing. But the idea of, you know, when a customer comes in, some restaurants in our world are there to sell. Our main entity idea in our company is about making the customer comfortable by not pushing or overselling. You know, maybe they're not hungry the night they come in, so they want to split and share something. Great.
A lot of restaurants don't let you do that.
Some of them charge you for
right.
a plate or whatever.
Right.
We look at it as we'd rather have somebody in a seat than no one at all. Make the customer comfortable, have them return many more times than possible than they can.
And what I notice at your restaurants, and you have how many, 14 of them altogether?
15.
15
this year.
In about four different states, is that right?
Yes.
But
yes.
Most of them in the Chicago
yes.
area. You have people who have been there for a long time, 20 years. I see the bartenders, they've been there, they're raising their kids, they're putting their kids through college. These are professional waitstaff people. How do you keep people like that?
Well, you treat them like you want to be treated. There's a lot of seniority, both in the front and the back of the house, and in all the restaurants, especially on Rush Street, Gibson's and Hugo's. At Gibson's, my partner is the original chef, Audrey Triplett. Kathy O'Malley, who runs our dining room, is original. I have 25, but this is just one. We have waiters, or we call them waitrons, let's put it that way.
Waitrons,
the generic term.
Yes.
Who are original. We've made the jobs both front and back of the house as a career. Many, many years ago, Stephen Hugo put together an insurance plan for all the employees that was reasonable, cost-effective. We've tried to give the staff a five-day work week, scheduling in advance. It's just been a... Something, the way you want to be treated is that's the way we treat the employees.
And it trickles down, and I think attitude is everything. I feel the same way, John, in my law firm, my little law firm. I don't have as many employees as you do, but I want my people to be happy because when they deal with my clients, I want them to be at their best, and I want them to be compassionate. I want them to be sharp, and I want them to have an attitude coming in to my office every day that's a good one, and that makes all the difference.
True. We also look at our management, too. That they treat the employees the same way that our founding fathers treated us. It's a big, big deal.
You know, Chicago seems to be more and more, I guess, sophisticated when it comes to culinary issues. Tell me about what you see as the trend and how Chicago is being viewed when it comes to restaurants.
Well, it's a funny thing you brought that up. Chicago has become... probably the culinary capital of the United States. Time Out just named Chicago as the best city in the world for 2018, in a huge part because of the restaurant scene and the bar scene. We were named in 2017 Restaurant City of the Year by Bon Appetit magazine, Best Restaurant in the City of America by Condé Nast Traveler. It's become the a culinary destination. Culinary tourism is another thing. I sit on the board of our convention bureau, Choose Chicago, and culinary tourism is really huge. We've done a lot of things in our city, very positive, to bring the culinary, those people who are into food and drink, to our city. We have a great show in the summer called the Chicago Gourmet Show in September at Millennial Park. We're the recipient of the James Beard Awards. They've chosen us, and I believe that they're going to be having the awards here until I think it's 2021. A big honor for the city to have those awards here. We have a lot of chef-driven restaurants also, a lot of Michelin-rated restaurants. We have everything. And we have an area, we have all the communities in the city that people can go to. You know, we have the Gold Coast, we have, you know, Randolph Street area, etc. But we also have the communities throughout the city where that culinary fair is there and exists.
If you have any questions for John Colletti, we're going to be talking through to the half hour. Give us a call here at 312-981-7200. And before we take a break, I want to just say we've had just a slew of new steakhouses. I just hear a new one every week. And Gibson's being a steakhouse, how is that good for competition to be out there? How do you distinguish yourself? Are there going to be too many steakhouses?
No, we love the competition. It seems like the more that come into the city, the busier we've
amazing.
We did a couple of things to solidify our steakhouse restaurant, Gibson's. We have our own beef program. We have our beef has been designated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as our prime beef, as Gibson's USDA Prime Angus. We're the only restaurant company in the country that has their own USDA designation. Our prime beef is actually one step over USDA prime. We have a group of cattle ranchers in the northern states, from Minnesota outwards, where everything that is slaughtered through this group of Black Angus cattle ranchers that is graded Gibson's Prime is ours. It's an unbelievable product. The product we have, you'll never see anywhere else.
And I have to say, even though I'm not a big steak eater, your fish is just as good as your meat is.
Well, you have to have, you know, we butcher our own fish. We buy whole fish and butcher that in a, we have a refrigerated cutting room on our second floor. We pride ourselves on that. We call ourselves a steakhouse that serves great fresh fish.
And it does. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. I'm talking to John Coletti with the Gibson's Restaurant Group. Stay tuned. You're listening to WGN.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me
welcome back
smile.
To the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're talking about dining out, and we're talking with John Coletti, who is a manager, partner of Gibson's restaurant chain. John, Valentine's Day is coming up, and the stats say that a quarter of all Americans will dine out for Valentine's Day. That's a lot of people.
It's amazing, and it's a... It's a huge day, and also the weekend after.
Right.
It's a huge, huge weekend.
Because you got to do the mistresses and the girlfriends.
Both sides.
I know back in the day, restaurant people were told never to ask if this is the missus, because you never quite knew. But
when they ask,
that's a terrible thing. We don't have to mention that. No. But let me ask you, how many dinners will you serve? Hugo's and Gibson's are both on Rush Street. They are right to, you know, together. Hugo's is more the seafood, right. Although you can get meat there too.
Sure.
And vice versa. How many will you do on Valentine's Day?
Probably Gibson's will do between 800 and 900 on Valentine's Day. Frogmore will probably do around 500.
It's just an amazing amount of people.
The thing is with Valentine's Day, it's all parties of two.
Right. Two tops.
Two to two all day long. It's for lunch and dinner for us at Gibson's and dinner at Hugo's.
I have a question. Yes. John, you know, people dine out all the time. Some people don't dine out very often, and Valentine's Day might be one of those days that it might be one of the only times of the year that you take your girlfriend out or you take your wife out. What tips do you have for people who go into a nice restaurant to, first of all, you pick a good restaurant. Let's just say we know that's a good thing to do. But what are some tips to ensure that you get good service?
Well, the astute diner who is spending his hard-earned money should expect service. Service first with a smile. That start out with the waiter, the good evening, those little nuances that should be given to all customers that walk in a restaurant. Some knowledge of what's going on with the menu, the explanation. We instruct our waiters and waitresses over the years. We're not the biggest upsellers in the world.
What does that mean? We don't push
appetizers, cocktails, brands of alcohol, side dishes, desserts, after dinner drinks. We want the customer to be comfortable. The astute customer in this day, he knows what he wants. You don't want to force the customer into a sale. We want the customer to come back, enjoy our ambiance, our fare. Many times, don't push him into a sale that he's gonna say, "Man, maybe I spent too much." Customers know what they want, but a waiter waitress can push somebody into a sale that they don't want to do.
Well, and you walk away feeling like you got too much food, and it's too expensive,
true.
And you may not come back for that very reason.
True.
Along those lines, what do you think about portions? Now, Gibson's and Hugo's do not skimp on portions. And there are some restaurants where Jerry and I, my husband and I, have tried where we go there and it's like, okay, now I need to order a pizza. I'm a big eater. You know, I exercise. I got a healthy appetite. I don't eat much for lunch. And when I come out of a restaurant not feeling, not overly full, that's not what I mean, but just that I've had enough to eat. What is the Gibson's theory on that?
That's a great, great question, Karen. The idea of where you're at, what type of restaurant you're dining at, whether it's a 2-3-star Michelin restaurant or a James Beard Award-winning restaurant or the restaurant down the street from your home, portion sizes are what they are. In our businesses, we serve a hefty portion, so we don't mind when a customer splits and shares an item. They might not be that hungry, or they could be that hungry. They want the whole entree, whatever. But we never push that. Our proportions are big compared to the world of food and beverage.
But you know, people can take it home, and there's nothing wrong having a piece of steak for breakfast.
So. No doubt about it. No doubt about that.
Now, there's a trend, I don't know if it's in place in all places in California, with this idea of no tipping, where perhaps the wait staff person is paid a substantially higher wage than minimum wage, and there are no tips. What do you think about that scheme?
We have we've talked about this over the years. I know the Illinois Restaurant Association is now involved in this discussion, but if you want to be a waiter, be a waiter. If you want to be a cook, be a cook. You know, you have to have a certain knack about being with the public. If you want to be a waiter, great. If a cook wants to come out in the front of the house, he has the abilities, great. But we're not too big believers in that that scenario.
You like the tipping scheme.
Yeah.
And to me, it works. I know in some places in Europe, I think Jerry and I were just in Barcelona, and I realized they were getting paid based upon how many tables they turned. Mm-hmm. So there was no upselling, but they definitely were moving you along. So instead of being paid on tips, they were paid on tables. I'm not sure I like that either.
I think you might lose in service.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I respect it. I was in Italy this summer and in France, and everything's included. You know, I would, if I had the great service, I would tip on top of what was there. But I go out to dine. I think we all go to dine for great service and great food. And reward that waiter waitress with a gratuity because of their service.
That's the scheme that works for me. I have to tell you a story, John, and this is typical of going to one of your nice restaurants. Jerry and I came back from a trip, and I was starving. It was something like we hadn't eaten all day, and we missed our layover, our plane, and it was late, and we got there, and we were told the kitchen was closed. And I was like, oh, I just wanted that seafood salad. I was thinking about it all the way home. And I was waiting, and I had a drink at the bar, and all of a sudden, out comes one of your bartenders with a seafood salad that he had gone to another restaurant in the neighborhood, which he knew was open, bought the salad for me and put it in front of me. And I was astounded that he did that.
It's all about service. And if you forget about service in our world, you're a loser. You have to take care of the customer.
And loyalty is earned, and he earned my loyalty that day.
Very true.
It was just a nice thing to do, and that those are the kind of people you have working there.
Yeah.
Let's just say you love to eat. You've been in the restaurant business your whole life. What is your favorite meal? If you were to sit down, your last supper on God's green earth, and you, what is the meal you're going to have?
You know, if you look at me, I'm not the skinniest restaurateur you ever saw. I've probably postponed a few meals, but I haven't missed any. But, you know, I love them all. I love breakfast, I love lunch, and I love dinner. You know, there's really, it's hard to really say which one. I have my favorites in all of them. In the city.
Your new restaurant is Gibson's Italia, and it's on Lake and Canal?
It's on Canal Street between Fulton and Lake Street in the River Point building.
And it's very different in atmosphere from Gibson's. It's not the old boys kind of feel. It's a lot of light and windows. It's really a beautiful place. I would recommend it for anybody. Even at lunch, it's a nice place to
go.
I think last time I was there, I saw the old Mayor Daley and a lot of interesting people having their lunch there. Very, very good. What is the concept with that new restaurant?
Well, it's the Italian steakhouse that we put together. My partner, Steve Lombardo, was the total instigator on that one, along with my partner, Greg Horan. It's a restaurant totally different than any of the ones we've opened up. First, the decor is totally different, as you said earlier. The views are views of the river going east like no Chicagoans have ever seen before.
It's a beautiful view.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Three floors, bar and grill on the second, main dining room on the third, and an event space on the fourth that has a retractable roof and windows. The fare is unbelievable. Chef Sosa has done a phenomenal job, and it's a restaurant that took off for us like no other. It has been busy since day one, and it's been giving rave reviews, and it's been amazing.
I sort of people ask me what it's like, and I say it's the same good Gibson's Hugo's food, mm-hmm. with just a little bit of an Italian flair, little bit of garlic, and a little bit of seasoning, and a little bit more spices that are Italian in nature, and it's very, very good. I would highly recommend it.
We make our own pasta, we make omelet, we make everything from scratch. All of our kitchens in the company are scratch kitchens. Italia has done some great, great things with the pastas. Great beef program also, but it's just been amazing.
John Coletti, I want to thank you for coming here, and I know I will see you out because you're always at your restaurants making sure there's good quality control, and I appreciate that. John Coletti with the Gibson's Restaurant Group, thank you for joining us, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
Great pleasure. Happy Valentine's.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. It's Karen Conti on the Karen Conti Show on WGN. I will be taking your legal calls probably right around 8:30. I'll give out the numbers now so you can jot it down. 312-981-7200 or text to that same number, 312-981-7200. I want to talk in our next segment about white supremacist groups are attempting to recruit on college campuses. I read a couple articles about it, and it's a very interesting and a very disturbing event. And with us tonight is Lonnie Nassiter, who is the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Welcome to the show, Lonnie. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Happy to be here.
Glad that you can join us on a snowy Sunday. Tell me, I want to talk a little bit about the phenomenon, then I want to talk a little bit about what the Anti-Defamation League does. But first, tell me what's going on with this white supremacists on college campuses.
Yeah, so we started really kind of seeing an uptick in terms of white supremacist incidents on college campuses. And when I say incidents, that includes anything from distribution of flyers to stickers, banners, posters, rallies, and we would include those types of things as an incident. And we saw a real uptick from what we measured before. In 2016, for example, we noticed that there were, you know, roughly about 41 incidents during the fall semester of 16, which was more than usual. But what was more startling was after we did all of our data dump after the fall semester of 17, it went from 41 to 147. So that's a significant increase. And if you take the numbers from 16 to today, it's about 346 incidents on college and university campuses, you know, and it's all over the country. It's not just in one segment in the South, for example, or in the West. They happen to be all over.
Interesting. And do you also track incidents of, hate speech also on campus, or is this more like concerted activity, not just isolated incidents that you're tracking?
One can argue that, you know, distribution of flyers can be considered speech, right? Because they're distributing language and all the rest. So we would, like I said before, we would do an incident, anything from a rally with a white supremacist group to distribution of flyers to putting stickers, in a university dorm room, having banners, you know, in the quad, posters that are put up in the cafeteria or in the union hall. These are things that we would deem incidents, and some of them, obviously, most of them have a speech element to it.
Got it. And again, you're not a person that can definitely give me this answer, but what are your thoughts about why we have such an increase in this kind of speech?
Well, I think that this has been swirling now for a while. I think there's a relationship in terms of what's happened in the last year or two in terms of many in the white supremacist world feeling a little bit emboldened by the current climate and feeling like their voice is now being heard at a level they hadn't been heard in a long time. As a result, they see this as an opportunity to spread their message of hate in a very strategic way, and that's targeting campuses where there are young people who may be impressionable. They can bring great energy to a movement, and extremists see real value in recruiting a new generation that can carry their movement into the future.
And again, I've always vowed, Lonnie, since I've gotten this show, not to be political, because there's certainly enough commentary on television and radio where people are taking one position or another, and I'm not asking you to get political, but are we talking about, I mean, in my view, what I see is people talking about a wall, people talk about, you know, sending people back. This kind of conversation, whether it's good in the long run or not, and I'm not going to comment on that, but is that what you're talking about, the climate of we've got to get rid of these people who are not white?
Yeah, well, I think there has been an objectifying of certain elements in our society of people that are minorities, certain colored skin, coming from certain countries, religions, et cetera. So the targeting of people has been somewhat mainstreamed in different parts of the country, including Washington, D.C. And as a result, now you're seeing this kind of open season on that type of rhetoric. And in fact, you know, we're seeing in terms of the propaganda that's on campuses, it's targeting not just Jews, but blacks and Muslims and non-white immigrants, as you just mentioned. And even the LGBT community is also the target of these posters and banners that we're noticing.
Let me take a slight detour a little bit. The Anti-Defamation League, can you talk a little bit? We hear about you all the time. And what I know what the origins are, but why don't we talk about the origins and we talk about what exactly is your mission?
Sure. Well, it's a twofold mission, and it started in 1913 right here in Chicago. A group of concerned citizens came together, and at that time, xenophobia was high, anti-Semitism was unfortunately high. It's the turn of the century. There were some very high-profile cases, one in particular coming out of Georgia involving a guy named Leo Frank, who was improperly imprisoned and then led to a death sentence. And so a group of people said, you know, we need to come up with an organization that not only fights anti-Semitism, but also secures justice for all people. And that mission statement has held true for us for the last 105 years now. And we advocate in many ways. We advocate in the courts. We advocate in legislatures. We do programs with young people. Our anti-bias programs go into schools and talk to kids about the importance of inclusivity, of respecting difference. We work a lot with law enforcement, not only in terms of giving them the landscape of extremist groups, as we're talking about earlier, but we also work with law enforcement on how to identify and properly prosecute hate crimes when they happen, which unfortunately we've seen an uptick in that as well. And we're also now venturing into a new area of work with law enforcement that is implicit bias work. It's talking to law enforcement about how we all have bias and how that bias plays itself out when they're actually policing communities and how they can actually turn some of their bias into something that's more productive and actually do a better job of policing communities that may look differently than themselves.
We're talking to Lonnie Nassiter with the Anti-Defamation League, and we're talking specifically about white supremacists who are targeting college campuses and trying to recruit followers among college students. Lonnie, we hear a lot about students not wanting to have certain speakers come to the college, and then there's a thought that, you know, unpopular speech is something that is a good thing in a way. We have First Amendment, and we should have people say negative things so there can be protests, so there can be confrontations, so we can hear the rhetoric and make our own decisions. How does the Anti-Defamation League still honor the First Amendment but yet be concerned about this kind of speech?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a fine line there. And, you know, there are certain speakers that are so beyond the pale that it makes it hard to continue to justify First Amendment grounds, especially if they're there to incite and start violence and all the rest. Then it becomes actually no longer protected speech. But, you know, our view has always been you fight bad speech with good speech. And so when we know that a white supremacist or somebody from the alt-right group is going to speak at a campus, we really try hard to educate faculty and students about the parameters of the First Amendment, their speech rights versus the speaker's speech rights, improving training for campus officials on responding to incidents that may come about because of that speaker. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with kind of making sure that you've put a foundation in place with the school that may be in a situation where they have these types of speakers that come in. So you do have to do your work, and you got to make sure that the university system is ready to take on that kind of speaker and what happens afterward and what's allowable and what's not. So it's a complex process. We aren't in the business of censoring speech, as you know, as abhorrent as some of that speech may be. We are not the thought police and we're not the speech police here, but we do a lot of trainings for education faculty on how to deal with these types of speakers when they come on campus.
One of the things that, and we're going to take a break in a minute, one of the things that surprised me by, actually I was watching some of the YouTube videos of some of the sophisticated white supremacist speakers, and they're not necessarily in your face racist and hateful. They actually appeal to logic, and when we come back from our break, I'm going to play a couple segments from them, and I'd like you to comment on how effective this kind of thing is on college campuses. Can you hold with me, Lonnie?
Sure.
Okay, we're talking to Lonnie Nassiter from the Anti-Defamation League. You're listening to Karen Conti on WGN. Hi, this is Karen Conti on the Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Lonnie Nassiter, who's the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Lonnie, you're with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I'm going to play a couple clips. Are you familiar with this guy, Mr. Spencer?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. This is a guy who claims to be from a group that is, I would just call him a white supremacist group, but he probably would call himself, I don't know, an anti-immigration group. But, Cash, why don't you play a couple clips that I found from YouTube? Go ahead.
There's one identity that's rendered, that's considered immoral, not illegal, and that is white identity, and that's what the alt-right is fundamentally about. It is a kind of post-national movement, as we've known these nations. It's something bigger. It's something that's evolving and forming, and that's why it's so exciting.
Let's try another one, too.
Being an immigrant, I mean, it's kind of pathetic, to be honest. Like, you're just, you know, you're kind of like shuffling off from your own country and you're just entering another one. And you're just kind of taking advantage of what other people have built. Just coming out, washing up on our shore. Give me a break. I wouldn't be proud of a nation of immigrants.
When you hear that.
There's something that's dripping in irony because, you know, all of us come from a different place. That's the beauty of America, right? So this notion that, you know, we're pristine and that, you know, we were never immigrants is just ridiculous if you look at history. But, okay. So, you know, Richard Spencer is one of the leaders of the alt-right movement. You know, he has been, you know, viewing it in a different approach than maybe his predecessors in the white supremacist movement. But make no mistake, he's just the white supremacist in a suit. And speaks a little bit more in more glossy terms and probably uses bigger words. But at the end of the day, he's all about white power. He's all about a country that is devoid of anything but the white race. And that is ultimately what he peddles.
Now, when he generally when he speaks on college campuses, what is the reaction to your knowledge?
The reaction is, you know, it draws a lot of passion, mostly on the anti side, to be honest. And again, you know, people get worked up on this stuff, and he's one of those that is clearly an agitator. And we saw it in Florida. There was a lot of people that were there to protest him, and there were some people also that were there in support of him. But by and large, the majority of the people that come out there that are really impassioned are against this message. You know, when we talk about these types of incidents at college campuses, our approach isn't to necessarily give support anti. We always say, why don't you do something productive, like do a peace rally, right? Do something that really flies in the face of all this awful language into something that's really productive and talks about harmony and bringing people together, which is the antithesis of what the message is for these guys like Spencer.
And just to make it clear, and I think you said this before, it's not that the Anti-Defamation League will throw roadblocks to get these people from not talking. It's
right.
To do something positive and to make people aware of what these people are really about.
Exactly. It's a combination of both. And so it's a combination, Karen, of shining a spotlight on who these people are. And again, you know, the notion that Richard Spencer is not a part of the white supremacist movement. Again, it's experts like ADL that said, actually, it's exactly the same rhetoric. It's exactly the same language, the same goals, just packaged differently. So shining the light and exposing and educating people like the viewers in your area and our area is one. And then, of course, also giving guidance on how to properly deal with this type of hate, whether it be through law enforcement, whether it be through the regular community, but figuring out ways to channel some of this frustration and angst in this really disgusting message into something that's much more productive and positive.
Has the Anti-Defamation League in some way quantified how college students are reacting to this in that? Is he changing people's minds? Are college students susceptible to going from not believing this rhetoric to all of a sudden thinking, well, maybe he might be right?
Well, I'd like to think that the majority of college students, while they're at a point in their life where obviously they're having an open mind, hopefully, if that means for everything, that they won't be swayed into this type of movement. These are educated kids that probably realize this is not the path forward in terms of our country. You know, are there going to be some that may be susceptible? Maybe, but we're not seeing hundreds or thousands of college kids flocking to these movements by any measure. You know, for them, it's a win if a few kids get an open mind and come to a rally and hear about what they're talking about. For them, that's a victory. And let's be clear here, Karen, also, that, you know, we're not talking about millions of people in this country that are part of a white supremacist movement. This is a very, very, very small percentage of our country that are a part of this movement. They've just been louder in the last year or two. And that's why I think many of us are so appalled when we hear this. At ADL, we're not, because this is kind of what we do. We've been monitoring these groups for so long. But I think your average person walking down the street who witnessed Charlottesville, I think, was horrified, and rightfully so, because it hasn't really come into our mainstream, and it shouldn't, but it has. And now, you know, I believe that there are a lot more good people out there that will push back against these messages.
Well, I hope so. I just want to share something with you. I don't remember what year it was, but I want to say it was the 1970s, and I was a girl growing up in Berwyn, and the Nazis announced that they were going to march in two places really close in time. I think maybe within the week, they marched in Berwyn and they marched in Skokie. Obviously, they marched in Skokie because there are a lot of Jewish people who lived there at the time. And Berwyn.
And one more thing. There were survivors. That was the real other reason why. Survivors of the Holocaust in Skokie. Sure.
That's absolutely. Mm-hmm. And again, being a young kid, I maybe didn't understand it completely, but I didn't quite understand why they marched in Berwyn other than, you know, there were some people in Berwyn at the time who may not have been as open-minded and liberal about having African-Americans live in their community and other people like that. That's how my takeaway. But I do have to say it was very memorable. Everything was closed. There was a lot of security. We stood and we watched the march, and it really impacted me for life. And it made me do some research to figure out who these people were and what their point was. But in some way, it was a very positive experience for me in that I understood their rights to march. I understood how offensive their message was. And it made me more aware of both of those things.
Well, that's good. I mean, sometimes you have these formative experiences in your life, which then really kind of shape the way you look at these things for the rest of your life. And clearly, you know, I didn't experience that, but I'm sure I would have come away with a very similar type of thing. And I'm sure those that did, who are good-natured people, probably it's always sticking in the back of their minds, especially when they see hate right in front of them. They almost recoil at it, and they go back to that day when they saw Nazis.
Exactly what I did was recoil.
Yeah.
You know, Lonnie, you've studied these kinds of things over time, and what kind of people are susceptible to this white supremacist movement? I mean, I think there's a thought that it's people in the South, and they're all rednecks, you know.
But that's not
really the case. Like,
no, it's not the case.
How does it start?
We saw it here, just last year in Luke Synagogue, where there was a person that was involved in the white supremacist movement went in and smashed the windows of Lube Synagogue, put two swastikas on the door, and, you know, we found out that he was a highly educated young man. So, you know, I think the notion that these are X, Y, or Z really doesn't play. They're coming from the South, the North, the West, and the East, and there are some that are really educated and highly educated, meaning going through college and even post-college, some that aren't. So I don't think you can necessarily pinpoint these are the types of people that are getting involved in these movements. I think at the end of the day, when I've talked to people that have been in the movement, that have subsequently gotten out of the movement, they will tell me that it really preys on people who are vulnerable, who are looking for some kind of connection, looking for some kind of kinship, a brotherhood, so to speak, feeling that somebody has your back. And there's a lot of ways to get that are positive. This is just a way that gets you there with really awful messaging and sometimes even, you know, playing it out into violence. So, you know, I think it kind of preys on people that are looking for, you know, a family, looking for relationships that are strong, looking for somebody that may feel the same way as they do. Again, kind of a kinship. And unfortunately, it's channeled into something really negative.
And one last little segment I want to talk about the Muslims. Is that a big problem? Is that one of your targets as far as the Anti-Defamation League goes, with all the talk of immigration from the Muslim countries and all the terrorism that's going on?
Yeah, sure. And ADL was really loud after 9/11 when we saw an uptick in terms of hate crimes against the Muslim community. as I said earlier, you know, this notion that we have this dual function, this dual purpose of fighting anti-Semitism, securing justice, it falls into the second pillar of really standing up for speaking out against all people who have been discriminated against or who have been the objects of hate. And in the Muslim community, unfortunately, we've seen a lot of Islamophobic rhetoric. We've seen ups and downs, spikes. It looks as though the reports from this year in terms of hate crimes nationally will continue to go up in the Muslim community, which is really of concern. There's usually a correlation between domestic terrorism, even if it's not even done by a Muslim. There's this quick kind of rush to judgment that it had to be a Muslim that carried out this terrorism attack, and then as a result, people feel like they need to then go after the Muslim community. So we do see upticks after their domestic terrorism attacks in this country, and we speak out against that. We also speak out when we feel that the Muslim community are not getting their proper due process, when communities who want to build a mosque are being clearly discriminated against. We've gotten involved in several different cases, standing up for their rights in terms of First Amendment rights to practice religion freely in this country. So it is clearly something that we have not shied away from, just the opposite, have spoken out when we see real violations against Muslims and their rights.
One last question before we take a break. Yeah. Hate crimes, I think a lot of people are confused about what a hate crime is. Can you tell, as a practicing lawyer,
yes.
you were a prosecutor
yeah.
for years.
I was a prosecutor, yeah,
and
yes,
you,
exactly.
I know you did a lot of good stuff.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'll explain it this way. So you have your basic offense. So if Karen, you and I got into an altercation and we got into a fight about, let's say, a money dispute, and it became verbal and I physically assaulted you, I would be probably charged with assault and battery, and I would go through the proper court system and all the rest, and whatever happened to me would happen based on the statutes for assault and battery. Now, if you and I got into an argument and I decided to punch you because it was about your gender, or it was about your race, or your religion, or something that's an immutable characteristic that's protected in this state, in Illinois, for example, and Illinois has numerous protected categories, many of which I just mentioned. But if, in fact, the crime is based on someone's own identity and immutable characteristic, then that assault and battery will be kicked up, so to speak, into like a felony. So you'll get a higher charge. The prosecutors can actually use the hate crime bias charge against the perpetrator. And so if let's say you're getting 6 months with a regular assault and battery, it would be kicked up to maybe a felony of 2 years, just using it as an example.
Got it.
And
okay.
That's what it is. And it's sending a chilling message, I believe, to people that, you know, hate crimes are a different type of crime. It's a crime based on someone's immutable characteristics, whether it be real, actual, or perceived, by the way. And it also sends the message for other people in vulnerable communities that law enforcement and elected officials are, in fact, treating those differently.
Lanny,
communities can suffer.
I want to thank you so much for joining us and keep up the good work. That's Lanny Nassiter of the American Defamation League. Thank you for joining us and have a good week.
You too.
Take care. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. On the Karen Conti Show, we will be taking your legal calls at 8:30. So get them in. I will have phone lines open. We're going to have Legal Olympics. I'm going to see how many calls I can take in a half an hour so I can get to all of your calls. That number is 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. And if you have any comments for any of my guests, you're always welcome to call in as well.
Now, are you trying to set a new world record?
I am.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, it's going to be a double toe loop legal answer.
Just make sure you land on the inside blade.
Yes, I will do that,
okay.
Roger. As long as I'm not curling,
yes.
Whatever that means.
Yes.
I don't want to curl.
I think it's a new sport. I don't know.
I don't know. All right, Roger. We are going to talk to two authors of a really fascinating book called False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. And it was written by two authors, two journalists who actually won a Pulitzer Prize for their investigation of this fascinating story of a teenager who was raped and then was charged with lying about the rape. Our guests are T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you? Are you both there with
great.
Me?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Great. I want to give you guys just a little bit more of an introduction because you're so amazingly qualified and have so many good things that you've done. Ken Armstrong is an award-winning journalist with the Seattle Times and the Chicago Tribune, where his work helped prompt our Governor Ryan to commute death sentences and later eventually ending up in the abolishment of the death penalty in Illinois. He's a professor in writing at Princeton and a fellow at Harvard. He has six IRE awards, which is an investigation. Help me with that one.
And investigative reporters and editors.
And editors. And Edgar Allan Poe Award and a Peabody Award. Welcome to the show. And then Team Christian Miller, senior reporter with ProPublica. He's a 20-year journalist and foreign correspondent covering four wars, a presidential campaign in 24 countries. You have Emmy Awards and Pulitzer Prize for this reporting. You guys, interesting story. How did you both come to the story? How did you first come to know that this was a story you wanted to report? And maybe start with Ken.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
It's interesting. We both came to this story separately. We did not begin working on it together. I live in Seattle, and Marie, the woman who was raped and not believed, she at the time was in Lynnwood, which is just north of Seattle. I was familiar with the fact that she had filed a lawsuit against Lynnwood, alleging that they had failed to protect her, basically, that they had fumbled the investigation when they concluded that she had lied about the case. I began looking at it because I was hoping that she would speak to her personal experience about what she had gone through in this case. And I was also hoping to reconstruct how the investigation in Lynnwood had gotten it so wrong. You know, how did they first begin to doubt her, and how did those doubts spread?
That's
what I wanted to look at.
And let's go to what happened here. T, if you can just maybe give us some background on what happened to Marie on that day, and then what happened afterwards that led to her being prosecuted.
Sure. So Marie was sexually assaulted in her apartment in Lynnwood, Washington, as Ken was saying. She reported that to police immediately. A neighbor called 911. The police responded. They began investigating the case very much as a rape case. But what happened is one of Marie's foster parents began to have some doubts about whether or not the incident had occurred. And it arose from kind of a natural common mistake, which is that the foster mother didn't believe that Marie was acting the way that a rape victim should act. And we know from studies and from lots of work out in the field that there is no way, single way to act or anything that kind of predicts that this person is a victim and the other person is not a victim. But that was enough to make the police begin to doubt some of Marie's stories, too. And eventually they brought her in, and she signed a series of different statements, confessions, after being subjugated to some interrogation by the police about whether or not she was telling the truth. So at the end of where our story began to pick up steam is the police eventually charged her with making a false report to the police department. And that for the police in Lynnwood, that was the end of the story. Where I came in, where I met Ken in doing the story, is I had been working on stories about how police and prosecutors don't do a good job in investigating rape. And one of my sources said, go look at this great job that was done in Colorado by a bunch of police in Colorado. And that's where, when I was interviewing these police, they had done a magnificent job in tracking down a serial rapist. And at the end of that, when they arrested the serial rapist, they were looking through the photos he had taken and the attacks, and they discovered a picture of Marie in Seattle, in Lynnwood. And so at that point in time, they were able to tell the police in Lynnwood, this is not a case of false reporting. Marie was raped. She had been raped.
So here she goes through this rape. It wasn't, not that it matters, but it's a stranger who comes into her home, ties her up, takes pictures of her, subjects her to rape over a period of time. She tells everybody about it. She changes her story due to whatever, maybe pressures put on by the police officers, maybe just her emotional state. We don't know. And she was prosecuted for it and actually pled guilty, did she not?
Yeah, she accepted a plea deal under which the conviction would be thrown out after a year if she met certain conditions. She needed to be on probation for a year. She needed to pay $500 in court costs. And she needed to get counseling, not for being raped, but for lying about being raped.
So, again, let's go back to the issue of rape. There is a thought, it just seems, that when women accuse men of rape, there's a higher standard. There's a higher standard of what were you doing? What time was it? Why were you out? What? And you would never ask a victim of burglary or robbery, why were you out at 2 o'clock in the morning? Why were you drinking? Are you sure that your stuff was really taken? It's just not how the investigation goes. But in rape investigations, maybe just generally, what do you see as being the wrong line of questioning? And T, maybe you can go on this one.
Sure. And Karen, you're pointing out kind of the long history of skepticism that exists in our legal system, as you know. And that's just, it's been very difficult for both prosecutors and investigators in some cases to kind of get over this idea that the woman had some role in the decision by a rapist to rape or attack her, right? So the kind of the best practices these days that the police investigators practice is to not come in with a lot of bias and conceptions about what it is that a rape should look like, what a rape victim should look like, what a rape scene should look like. And the idea is listen to the victim and then verify and follow up what they say. That's one of the police in our book who spoke to us. Her advice was you listen to what the victim says, and then you corroborate that evidence, and you work very hard to kind of suspend whatever your own biases may be, and just look at the facts, and where do the facts take you?
One of the things that your book really hits home on is, you touched upon this, there is no victim mentality. You know, this was a girl who was in 20 foster homes. She had been sexually and physically abused throughout the process. She was a survivor, it seems, and it seems that she's still a survivor, and a person like that may or may not react the same way that somebody else who didn't have that experience would react. And it was interesting to me that the people who were closest to her, largely the foster parent, was skeptical. And I found that just really sad, that the person who supposedly loved her the most was the one who kind of brought to the attention of the police that she may not be telling the truth. What do you make of that?
Right. Marie did have a history of sexual abuse tracing back to her childhood, and people with a history like that are more likely to shut down when it happens again. And in her case, two of her foster mothers simply didn't understand her lack of affect after she reported being raped. She seemed emotionally detached. She didn't seem to be hysterical or crying. They didn't understand all kinds of things that she was doing in the immediate aftermath. She wasn't making eye contact. She didn't hug them. All of these things they interpreted skeptically, and that skepticism was then communicated to the police department and incorporated by the detectives, you know, who are in charge of the investigation. And it's true. I think that with both of the foster mothers, they have genuine affection for Marie. And I think that shows how deeply ingrained these misconceptions can be when those people who are even close to you and affectionate towards you misinterpret those signals. That tells you how commonly that can happen.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking about a great book called False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, and we're talking to the authors T. Kristen Miller and Ken Armstrong. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk more. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, a book that you should read. It's very, very interesting. The research behind it resulted in an article that won the Pulitzer Prize for these two authors I have on tonight, T. Kristen Miller and Ken Armstrong. Thank you again for joining us. You this is a case where a teenager was raped. She recanted, but it really happened to her. It was proven that it happened to her, and she was falsely prosecuted for lying to the police officers. There, the guy who was the perpetrator, and the book isn't really much about the perpetrator. It's more about the victim and how this investigation went wrong. But this guy was a serial rapist. And, Ken, can you tell us a little bit about this guy and what his background was?
Sure. He was raised in Colorado and went into the military after 9/11. And he became, he said that he realized from a very early age, from the time he was 5 years old, that there was something wrong with him. He traces it to seeing one of the Star Wars movies.
That was astounding, that he was watching that at age five and somehow came up with some fantasy about enslaving women.
That's right. When he saw Princess Leia, you know, chained up in Jabba the Hutt's lair, he said that that triggered in him fantasies, and that for the rest of his adolescence and adulthood, it's something that he was wrestling with, this feeling that, you know, he needed to see fear in women. What's interesting is, you know, T and I were able to interview him in Colorado, and it was clear that he had studied rape, that he had figured out the ways in which rape is investigated and how he could avoid being caught. He would destroy DNA. He avoided fingerprints. He encrypted electronic files. When we talked to him, he described himself as being proficient at rape. That's the word he used, proficient. And he had this entire vocabulary about rape that was militaristic and dehumanizing. He would talk about how he would seek out a target-rich environment, to use his words. It was chilling talking to him because you realize that this was someone who he had in his possession the rape investigation handbook. He knew what police do and what they don't do. He would not commit. He would move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction when he was committing these assaults because he knew that police have a reputation of not cooperating with one another. So he figured that the patterns that he was establishing would not be picked up if he simply kept moving from county to county or city to city.
And I suppose that's what is the reason that he was successful at being a serial rapist. Had he not been disorganized, had he not been cognizant of getting caught and being one step ahead of the police, this may have been a one and done. But this guy was, as you say, methodical. And what I found slightly interesting was that he didn't really come from a family where there was trauma. He was married at some point. He was intelligent. That doesn't surprise me, I suppose. But he didn't come from a background where you would say, I could see that coming. Was that at all surprising to you, either of you?
Well, I mean, one of the things is that we have relied mostly on the serial rapist's name is Mark O'Leary. Our interview with Mark O'Leary and his interviews in court when he talks about his family background. So, you know, he is a convicted serial rapist. He may or may not have a reason to have look at his background with different eyes than maybe somebody else who is looking at it. So, yes, he certainly says that he came from a loving family, that he always felt like this was something that he had to hide from his family. And we are fairly certain that his family didn't know exactly about what was happening until he actually stood up and made a confession in court. So he was very practiced and skilled, as Ken said, not only at hiding this crime from the cops, but hiding it from everyone in his life. His wife had no idea that he was sort of sneaking around at night, stalking women. He would spend hundreds of hours outside apartment complexes looking for victims that he could attack. So he was definitely somebody who was adept at hiding just who he was.
You know, I have a theory, and I'm not sure if it plays out in this case, but it seems to me that people who are predators, like this guy was obviously a predator, kind of knows his prey, and I have seen over the years where women who maybe aren't going to be believed because they're drunk or because they have psychological issues or because they're somehow perceived as being weak, that the predators will pick up on that somehow and know instinctively that those are the people they go after. Did you get any of that sense from this guy?
Well, from this guy, he developed a checklist. So in general, Karen, both Ken and I have covered cops for, of course, for many years, and it's not a mystery that that occurs, that rapists sort of seek out women in vulnerable positions as victims and groom them for attack. In his case in particular, though, it was almost a challenge to him to attack these women and to achieve his goals. So he would have a very sort of like kind of a checklist he would go through. He would look for women who were single, first of all. He preferred women who lived by themselves in houses instead of apartment complexes, because apartment complexes had a lot more eyes around them. He would never attack a dog in the house because he basically scared that the dog might attack him or sound the alarm. So he had a very kind of a checklist on him. And some of it's not necessarily like an emotional checklist, but sort of a physical safety checklist he would go down before he would select his victims.
Let's talk about the statistics. From the best research that you've done, what is the statistic on how many women falsely accuse men of rape? Because it sounds, when you hear these kinds of issues come up, you would think it happens all the time. What is your best stat on that?
So the statistics, any statistics about sexual assault, that is a very difficult time, crime report to investigate, are to be taken with a little bit suspicion. The standard figure you'll hear is that 2% to about 8% of false reports are provably false. In other words, 2 to 8% of the rapes that do get reported, which is not all of them, can be shown to be actually false. This isn't like an assumption that a cop makes or a prosecutor makes. This is where they've gone out and they've looked and they found, yes, indeed, there's no way that this sexual assault occurred. And that's about 2% to 8%. The number could be higher than that because most false report allegations don't get investigated in the same way that most rape allegations don't get investigated. So that's the number you hear. But just keep in mind that any number with sexual assaults tends to be somehow obscured by the stigma which surrounds the crime itself.
Now, this Me Too movement, it's kind of a timely time to have a book out like this, obviously. And as you watch this whole thing unravel, what was your thought about the parallels between what happened to Marie and what happened in this case with all these women who are now coming forward, especially in the Hollywood arena?
It seems with the what's at the heart of the Me Too movement is this frustration with not being heard, with having reports of harassment or worse, be minimized or discounted. And Marie's experience exemplifies that, captures that in about the most tragic way possible. You know, if Marie wasn't heard, if she wasn't believed, here's a woman who was attacked at knife point in her home by a stranger, a woman who had bruises on her wrist, who went to the hospital for an exam, who cooperated with police every step of the way. If she isn't heard, if she isn't believed, how much faith can others have who come forward?
Absolutely. I think that rings loud and clear. I want to thank you both for coming on. T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong, the authors of False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. How can people pick up your book?
Amazon, all major bookstores, independent booksellers, Barnes & Noble. I should be able to find it hopefully everywhere.
And what does a Pulitzer Prize look like? Just asking. What does it look like?
A small block of Tiffany glass.
All right. Now I know. Not that I'm ever going to get one, but I can always hope. Thank you so much for joining us on this cold night in Chicago. Good luck with your book and have a good Valentine's Day. The 47th anniversary of the debut of Tapestry by Carol King. I don't know if any of you saw Beautiful at the Cadillac Palace Theater, but oh, wasn't that the best?
Just fantastic.
I'm sorry that I waited because I would have gone back to see it again.
Well, I'm sure it'll come back. Most of those hits keep coming back.
And the thing is that you don't realize how many songs this woman wrote.
Well, I know.
That she didn't even perform.
Yeah.
That were performed by people over the years. Just amazing,
yeah,
amazing. Just, go see it.
And a little side note.
Yes.
And I've said this before, and because I'm so proud of it. The original star on Broadway, Jesse Mueller, and her sister, who starred in the Chicago, the original Chicago production, were both students of mine at Evanston High School.
Oh, my goodness. You taught them everything they know.
Yeah, right. I doubt that.
Thank you for that fun fact, Roger.
Okay.
Let's go back to your Olympic reporting, okay?
Okay.
All right. Well, you're listening to Karen Conti's show, and this is the time that you can call in and give me your legal question, and I will help you at 981-7200, 312-981-7200, or you can text me to that same number. And if you don't want to call me here, and if you don't get a chance to talk, please call me at my office at 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Let's go. Paul, welcome to the show. You have a question about workers' comp.
Yeah, Karen, hi. Thank you.
Hi.
I've been waiting all day to talk, and I'm so glad it wasn't a Blackhawk event tonight. I was in a workers' comp case. I was injured in February of 2009, and it finally got resolved and settled in June of 2016. It was 7.5 years of, it was just a nightmare. Before I signed off on the papers, my attorney assured me that they'd check with me twice, that all my medical bills would be paid for. There was a total of about $30,000 outstanding. After about 4 months, I was starting, you know, I feel better, ready to get out of my life and deal with this nightmare. I started getting letters from an orthopedic office up in Elk Grove, and I talked to my attorney. It was kind of, he said, she said, that he went back and forth with the other attorney, and I thought everything was resolved. Now I'm getting calls from the collection agency, and I'm thinking I'm about ready to get served, and it's found collections, which doesn't seem fair, either negligence or somebody dropped the ball on this, and I'm really very,
sure.
Very
Paul,
nervous about this.
Can I ask you how much is at stake, just generally?
I'm sorry, what?
How much are they asking for?
Well, the total is close to about $30,000 now with legal fees and subpoenas, and it's really getting serious.
Okay, no, what I'm saying is, how much do you owe the provider?
Oh, the main orthopedic office up in Elk Grove is about $18,500
was
based, and now there's penalties.
Okay, so let me put you on hold, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how this happens. So you're injured at work. You have all these medical bills. The company is supposed to be paying those medical bills, and when you get a settlement, the settlement should go to pay those medical bills to the extent that you have to pay those back from your health carrier. The lawyer's responsibility, a plaintiff's lawyer in the workers' comp realm, has the obligation to try to take care of those liens, take care of those providers so that everyone is paid off and that the settlement money all goes to the right places before it goes to the attorney or to the plaintiff. So that lawyer should have done that correctly, making sure that you gave that lawyer notice of those medical bills. I'm probably sure that that's what happened because it was that's part of the process in bringing that lawsuit. So I would put pressure on the lawyer that it's the lawyer's obligation to get those things paid. And if he doesn't do it, then that might be a step you take in that direction to try to force that lawyer to make those payments and make them good. Again, $18,000 is a small amount of money to sue anybody. But on the other hand, you don't want to be sued by the provider because you will be obligated on those medical bills. So if you need help in how to go in that direction, maybe some strategies, Paul, you can send me an email at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Our numbers here are 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Robert. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Karen, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a snow issue. I have a rather contentious neighbor who, when he blows his snow on it from his driveway, blows it right up along my house, which is fairly close to his driveway. Now, right now, I have about a 5-foot high pile of snow up against my house. Do I have any legal grounds to stop him from doing it?
Well, he can't put the snow on your side of the boundary. And I take it it's up against your house. It's on your property. And he shouldn't be doing that. Now, the problem with these kinds of disputes is that whatever the legal issue is and whatever the law is really takes a back seat to how to handle this. Because when you have a neighbor, and believe me, I have had these cases for 30 years, they can be very significant in how vicious they are. If you have a neighbor who likes to do this on purpose, listen, a normal neighbor doesn't want to offend their neighbor, right? You don't want to do anything to harm them. You don't want anything to anger them. And if he's doing this and he knows this is angering you, there's something wrong with him. Okay. So how to handle this? I always say handle it directly, nicely. Do you mind not putting your snow? It's impacting my house. I can't see out my window. I can't walk through my yard, whatever the issue is. And say it nicely to them. They start with that. If that doesn't work, then sometimes municipalities will have within their municipal office or a police department. I know Oak Park had it through, I believe, their police department, where you could go and have them mediate a neighborhood dispute. That's not available everywhere, but that's an option as well. And so the other thing is it a violation of some code? I don't know if it is, but you could call your city and see if the neighbor could be cited for that. Again, that might cause more hostility and not resolve the problem. Bringing a lawsuit just doesn't make sense over snow, and it's too expensive, and you're not going to go anywhere with that except lose a lot of money and probably not get a neighbor who is any nicer to you in the long run. I understand the seriousness of these things. They can be very, very disconcerting. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Buddy. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. What's your legal question?
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I was accused of rape. I was listening to an earlier program, and the lady that I was seeing at that time was kind of a little nuts. And I was arrested twice, and the police threw everything out of court. But I was curious, is there any way I could get a restraining order against this woman to keep away from me?
Is she still continuing to contact you?
Not at this moment, but with all this stuff going on in society now.
Yeah, okay. So
I'm afraid that maybe she might put it back out there to the police department.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold. This is being falsely accused is one thing. Protective orders are another thing. Protective orders are generally when someone is harassing you directly. So they're coming to your house. They're stalking you. They're calling you incessantly. They're threatening to hurt you. So that's what a protective order is for. And certainly if there was that kind of contact, you might have a right to go and get an order of protection. But there's no such thing as getting someone an order against someone where they can't go to the police. It sounds to me that the allegations have been made. If he hasn't seen her, Buddy, if you haven't seen her in a while, there's no further allegations. If the allegations have been dropped and there's no more charges, there doesn't seem to me to be anything that you can be concerned about. And again, you really can't go and preemptively say, you can't report me to the police. I would just keep my distance and be glad that she's not contacting you anymore. Let's go to Ruth, and I'm going to give out the numbers again, 312-981-7200. We'll be taking your calls all the way to 9 o'clock. Ruth, welcome to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Hey, Karen. I have a question for you. This is like an old thing in my life. I had a lawsuit, only one in my life, for a condo that was filled with mold, and I hire lawyers that sign the contract with me that, you know, that they would get a certain percentage of whatever I would gain from this suit.
Sure.
But then they made me come into their office and do paperwork and, like, go through files. And I just have a question about that. I thought I had to take off days from work to go and work for them. This is like a really good firm in Chicago, and I thought, this can't be right. And it's just a question that I've always had in my mind.
Okay. And, Ruth, I'm going to answer it generally and not get into any specifics of exactly what you're doing because I'm going to need to take a break. But I'll put you on hold and answer. Generally speaking, you have an obligation as a client to cooperate with your attorneys. And even if you're being they're being paid on a contingent basis, you still have an obligation to do the discovery, which means produce documents and go through documents and answer interrogatories, which are questions, and to sit for a deposition and to come to court if the judge wants you to come to court. I ask my clients to help out in cases as well because, first of all, it's easier for them to do it and they know the facts better than I do. So it's a cooperative effort to put litigation together and to put it in a form and to be persuasive. That's common. That's a very common thing. I wouldn't look at it as you were doing their work. You were helping them do the best job they could. I that's my best answer to you, and I think that if you get involved in litigation, that's something that you have to be willing to do because it is time consuming. There are days from work that you'll have to take off, and there'll be times when you have to do some work to help your lawyers. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Please give me a call if you have any legal questions.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law?
It's the Karen Conti Show on WGN. This is your time to get in legal questions. We still have about 10 minutes. So give me a call or a text at 312-981-7200. And if you don't get to talk to me on the air or you don't want to talk to me on the air because it's private, you can call me at 312-332-7800 and leave me a confidential phone message. Or you can text me. Actually, you can call, email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to Tim. Welcome to WGN. Tim, you have a legal question.
Yes. 15 years ago, I was involved in a car accident where I was sitting at a stoplight waiting to turn. It was red. And I got rear-ended by a guy. And turned out he didn't have any insurance. But he had land and money and that. And so we go to court. He doesn't show up. And it turned out the judge issued issued me $29,000, and then my insurance company had to pay the $6,800 for my neck. I mean, he nailed me pretty good. And so it was with interest. And now I know a guy that worked at the Treasury Department, and I still have a lien on his property. Well, turns around, he died a month ago. And so I call up my lawyer, and I didn't really talk to her. I talked to a kid that her helper.
Okay.
And he says, no, he filed Chapter 11. You can't get anything. I said, when did he file Chapter 11? A few years ago. And I have, from a judge, it's all legal and everything, since he never showed up, and they couldn't, when he,
okay.
Somebody go up to the door to serve papers, he'd say, I can't.
Okay, so let me...
Is there any other way around it?
Let me go through this a little bit. I'm going to put you on hold. So first of all, a couple things just so we all know. 15 years ago, you get a judgment against somebody. That judgment is good for 10 years, generally speaking, and then you have to refile to extend it. So just know that if you ever have a judgment against somebody, you have to take some action to extend it when the 10-year period comes. Not sure if that happened here. The second thing that you're talking about is you have a lien, and that lien is valid. Apparently, he filed for bankruptcy sometime in between getting that judgment and between the time he died. So if he did file bankruptcy, that debt would have been what we call discharged in bankruptcy. And generally speaking, all debts that you have are discharged in bankruptcy except a few things like tax liens or if you committed fraud. If there was something that was fraudulent and you were accused and convicted of that, or not convicted of that, but there's a judgment relating to some dishonest conduct, that does not get discharged in bankruptcy. A plaintiff's personal injury case where there's a judgment is not such an action. So therefore, that would have been discharged in bankruptcy. If you wanted to fight that, you would have to fight the estate for the right to bring that. Let's just say that you weren't given notice of that bankruptcy. Maybe that's a defense. You probably are going to need to talk to either a bankruptcy lawyer or a probate lawyer, an estate lawyer, who can tell you whether or not you can proceed to try to collect against the estate. But my guess is, from what you've told me, that the chances are not very good of getting getting any relief. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Paul. Welcome to Karen Conti's show on WGN. You have a legal question.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Yes. So my father moved from southern Indiana up to Chicago back in the teens, and he lied about his age to get a job in a steel mill. So he worked in the steel mill. He organized for the union. He joined the union. He worked in the union for 45 years. And when he passed away, the union denied him death benefits. This, my brothers and I were just talking about this last week. So I'm just wondering, I've heard of other people that the unions have, you know, resolved those issues. I mean,
why did they deny death benefits?
They said that he lied about his age on his application.
But even if he had given his correct age, he still would have been employed there long enough to receive benefits. Is that fair to say?
That would be fair to say. You know, I'm just wondering, is there a limitation as far as can you go back? And I mean, the Steelworkers Union is still there. I mean, just wondering.
So, and again, remind me, when did your father pass away?
He passed away in the 70s.
Oh, in the 70s?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so yes. When you said the teens, sometimes. Okay. So, yeah, you know, that any statute of limitations is going to have run by that time, Paul. You know, that's not worth even looking into. Statute of limitations are pretty short for these types of things. But it's an interesting problem, and I actually have dealt with that issue before where people lie to get a job. And I actually had a guy on a fire department lie to get a job, and they refused to use his real date of birth. They used his fake date of birth and to deny him some pension benefits. So I've had these issues one way or the other, and they're largely driven by the union contract. So you're always better off, just for people who are listening, this doesn't apply to you, Paul, because there's really no the time is gone. But for these kinds of issues, the best thing to do is to get your union lawyer, who they don't always come to your rescue, but when they should, but they're the ones who are in the best situation to know what the rules are and how to get around them if you need to.
Okay.
All right? Well, thank you for the call.
Right.
It was an interesting one. Okay. Take care.
Okay.
Let's go to Heidi. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. I just have a minute, so if you could get...
quick question.
Sure.
My father passed away about 15 years ago, and I've been contacted by an asset recovery company about some abandoned bank accounts of his. And I was wondering if these are legitimate companies and what experiences people have with them.
That's a good question, and I frankly don't know the answer to it. I've never heard of a company that comes after you and says, you know, I have this account for you. Usually it's, you know, you can go to the Treasury Department, Illinois Treasury. They have lost bank accounts that have been abandoned, and I always go there hoping that maybe I can retire that way, but it's never worked for me. But in any event, I would not be trustful of these people. You might want to actually send me an email and let me see if I know anything or know anybody who knows the answer to that. WGN@AskKarenConti.com or 312-332-7800. But you also might want to just Google them, of course, and also call the Attorney General's office in Illinois. Maybe they have some information about whether or not this organization in particular is reputable. But that go on their website, get a phone number, see if you can get a live person to talk to at the Illinois Attorney General's office. Hope that works for you, Heidi. Good luck. And let me know what happens. I'd like to be able to tell other people, you know, what you learn. All right?
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.